Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I am your host, Crawford Gribben. Today, my guest is Dr. Adrian Neely. Adrian is director of the doctoral program and professor of historical theology at Puritan Reformed Theological Seminary in Grand Rapids, Michigan, USA. Adrian is a prolific author of works on Reformed scholasticism and what we might call the Dutch Puritan movement. And today we're going to be talking to Adrian about his most recent publication, a volume he has edited with Van den Hoek and Ruprecht called Petrus van Maastricht, 1630 to 1706, Text, Context, and Interpretation. Adrian, congratulations on the book, and welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Crawford, for having me on your show.
It's always a pleasure to have you come and talk about your work. The last time we spoke, it was about your previous project on Van Maastricht, which was a book called Before Jonathan Edwards. Before we dive into this book, the Van den Hoek and Ruprecht book, could you remind us a little bit about Before Jonathan Edwards and how you used Van Maastricht in that book to talk about the sources of New England theology?
Yeah, in my Oxford book, Before Edwards, the sources of New England theology is primarily concerned with the theological sources, the theological background of what we find in the writings of Jonathan Edwards. Over the last 20 years, many publications on Edwards and after Edwards has shaped scholarship. What was missing is to show that Edwards was deeply rooted in Reformed Orthodoxy and Reformed Scholasticism, and that these sources have shaped his theology. And although he appropriated that in his own time, and as such, that Edwards can be seen as a transitional figure, but deeply rooted in the Reformed Orthodoxy of the 17th century.
Now, that book, the Oxford book that you just mentioned, was not your first publication on Van Maastricht, was it?
No. In the Oxford book primarily focus on Jonathan Edwards, but I use Maastricht as an example of continuity and discontinuity in terms of theological development between the time of Maastricht and Jonathan Edwards. In my earlier work, 2009, a Brill publication, Peters van Maastricht, Reformed Orthodoxy, Method and Piety, focuses on that method, particularly the scholastic method and piety, can go together and is very very visible in the publication of Peters van Maastricht, Theoretica Practica Theology, where he really keeps the theory and the practice of theology together.
So Petrus van Maastricht is someone who has become very important to you, and very important about the way you think about the development of Protestant theology and its evolution, I suppose, through different contexts and in different periods. Before we begin talking about your most recent book, the Van den Hoek and Ruprecht edition that's just come out, could you remind us who was Van Maastricht and perhaps remind us why he matters?
Yeah. Maastricht lived primarily in the so-called High Orthodoxy period of the Reformed Orthodoxy from 1630 to 1706. And I see him more and more as a codifying figure of Reformed theology of the 17th century. So on the one hand, I would say he is not unique. But on the other hand, he has some very interesting features. For example, all of the theological loci are addressed exegetical, doctrinal, polemical, and practical. So this fourfold approach to theology, which was present in, say, the Christian theology and Reformed theology of the 17th century, comes together into Maastricht. Secondly, he is more known as the theologian, but in his time he was more known as the philosopher, particularly the anti-Cartesian philosopher, as his philosophical works, which not have been studied that widely yet, were well known not only in the Reformed circles on the continent, but also in the Lutheran and even the Roman Catholic circles. And his philosophical publications were widely used in the polemic against Cartesian thinking. And then lastly, I think what he also is somewhat forgotten, his main drive was preaching. He wrote, of course, the disputation on the best method of preaching, but in his preface to the Theoretica Practica Theologica, he writes that he writes this systematic theology in the service of preaching. And for Maastricht, all doing theology and all of our doing theology comes together on the pulpit in preaching. And those three elements, systematic theology, philosophy, and homiletics, are three very important pillars that we see in the Reformed Orthodoxy of the 17th century, but come all together in Peters van Maastricht's work.
And of course, the essays in this new volume pick up on each of those three themes, don't they? And maybe we'll have a chance to speak about some of those essays later on. But before we do, could we talk a little bit, Adrian, about scholarly context? Very helpfully, at the end of your book, you've included an appendix which lists all the publications, or many of the publications, on Van Maastricht in the 18th century, when there's maybe less than a dozen, on the 19th and 20th centuries, when there's really only a handful of publications in each century. But then you note that in the 21st century, there are somewhere in the region of a couple of dozen publications already, and we're only at 2020. So what has happened in the field to turn Van Maastricht from being a relatively neglected, perhaps even forgotten figure, to become the centre of so much scholarly activity at the beginning of the 21st century?
Yeah, thank you for asking me. This is a very important question for myself as well, and that was also one of the motivating reasons to get this book together with a number of scholars. Maastricht was kind of widely known because of the quote of Jonathan Edwards, who claimed that in a letter to Joseph Bellamy, he said, Turretin is very nice and is very important, but if you really want to have good theology on exegesis and doctrine, polemic and practice, you go to Maastricht and he is the best, except the Bible. And that is how far Maastricht was known to many, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon world, not realizing that many of the in the time of Jonathan Edwards were very familiar with Peters van Maastricht. He was the preferred theologian to go to in the early 18th century in New England. What we anticipated as contributors to this volume, that what we have seen in the scholarship of Turretin, for example, when Turretin was published in the English language, we have seen an enormous increase of attention to Francis Turretin and his theology and his works. And now with the translation and publication of the Theoretica Practica of Maastricht, we anticipate, or we anticipated when we started to work on this collection of essays, that a similar trend will be seen in scholarship around Petrus van Maastricht. So this book was really put together by a number of scholars to say, okay, anticipating this new wave, let us set some tones, but also let us also show some aspects that really need to be worked on in the future. And Carl Truman, in his foreword to this publication, has highlighted the importance of doing that, not only showing what has been done, but also to show what should be done in Maastricht research.
So in many ways, this book is a roadmap, isn't it? A roadmap that plots out possible journeys through van Maastricht's work in future scholarship. But before we...
In part, yes. But I think also a path less traveled because of, for example, take the exegetical work of Petrus van Maastricht. What you don't see, for example, in Francis Turretin, Maastricht was a Hebraist, was considered in his time as a Christian Hebraist, his deep acquaintance with the rabbinic tradition, and all his disputations. For example, he has a sevenfold disputation on Isaiah 53, deeply rooted in rabbinic exegesis. There, a lot of work needs to be done, and how that will be shaped over time, that needs to be seen.
Yeah, that's helpful to be reminded that so much of this work is exegetical in nature. As we approach the text, Adrian, the first major essay comes from Ryan McGraw, and Ryan is thinking about van Maastricht's relationship to Reformed scholasticism or to confessional orthodoxy. What is it that makes van Maastricht distinctive in that context?
Well, I think there also the international character of Petrus van Maastricht is coming out. Let me go two ways about it. In the first aspect, Petrus van Maastricht belongs primarily to the post-Reformation Reformed Orthodoxy era, and lesser, and almost, I would say, not immediately to the so-called Dutch Further Reformation or the Nadere Reformatie. In that regard, he is different than, for example, Herman Witsius, which was well known as a Nadere Reformatie figure in his time. Maastricht is, first of all, internationally shaped. I mean, he grew up in as German, what we call now Germany, in Cologne, studied in Utrecht, went back to the Cologne area to serve there, served in Gluckstadt, in a very international congregation, but then moved to Frankfurt an der Oder, where he was participant of a merger of churches between the Lutheran and the Reformed tradition. And so he was a participant in I would say, a very ecumenical enterprise. Then he goes back to Duisburg, where he studied before, to become professor at the University of Duisburg, which was very Coxean in his conviction, and he participated there. Actually, he says later on in his Theoretica Practica that the Fuchsian Coxean divisions are unnecessary and should be overcome. He's very ecumenical in that regard. Then he has made a trip to England for English practical theology. So he had a very international outlook. And I think that represents also the character and the depth of Reformed Orthodoxy of the 17th century. This international aspect, this, say, somewhat ecumenical aspect of Reformed Orthodoxy.
Now, you mentioned there that famous dispute that takes place in the mid-17th century among many Dutch theologians who line up either behind Vutius or Coxeus. And you tell us that van Maastricht has a mediating position there, or thinks that these disputes can in some ways be brought to a happy and fruitful conclusion. Could you remind us what that dispute was, and also explain to us in what way Van Maastricht thought it could be brought to an end?
Well, I mean, to be very brief, Coxey stands more in an Aristotelian philosophy that he adheres to, very analytical in his exegesis, analytical, grammatical in his exegesis, very traditional view on the covenant, for example, which became one of the issues that the saints in the Old Testament found their complete salvation only when Christ died on the cross, which was more or less, in simple terms or simplified terms, Coxey's position. Fuchs did see that different. Fuchs did see the whole issue on the Decalogue, particularly the commandment on the Sabbath, on the Lord's Day. He saw the difference as Coxey's. And then also in terms of covenant theology, where Coxey's really developed, he was not the first one, but a more comprehensive federal theology than was done before. And what you see then in Maastricht, he combines. He's a certain aspect of Coxey's, particularly in his covenant theology. He really follows Coxey's, as did, I think, to a certain extent, Herman Witsius as well in his book on the covenants, which has, I think, strong Coxeian notions. And on certain aspects, he adheres and follows Fuchs, for example, on the Decalogue and on the issue of the saints on the under the Old Testament. He follows more Fuchs. But so he tries to go his via media his own way by benefiting from Fuchs' interpretation and as well Coxey's, particularly in federal theology. And therefore, I think that is also one of the reasons why he became extremely popular in New England, of this adherence of federal theology, which was very prominent in the theologians of the 18th century of New England.
That's fascinating. One of the other chapters that really jumped out at me in this volume was the chapter by Jonathan Beakey, who suggests that Van Maastricht's political theology requires us to reconsider some of the arguments that have been made about so-called two kingdoms theology. Can you explain to us perhaps why Jonathan Beakey's chapter is so important in that regard?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have Jonathan Beakey in the group to work on this topic. Jonathan defended his own doctoral work on the twofold kingdom of Christ last year at the University of Groningen, and his work will be published later this month by Brill. It is an outstanding work on the development in various places around Europe on the understanding of the twofold kingdom of Christ in the particular the post-Reformation era. But he had not addressed yet Peter van Maastricht. So I invited him to write his contribution. And as you noticed, it is an outstanding chapter, which I think rounds off scholarship. I mean, in post-Reformation scholarship, particularly after the work of, say, Carl Truman and Richard Müller and Willem van Asselt, there are so many, say, gaps still available for us to explore. And this is one of those gaps that really need the attention. And Jonathan's contribution coming out just out of a very comprehensive study of 17th century Reformed understanding of the twofold kingdom of Christ is just a tremendous example of gaps that are filled with this volume, with this chapter in scholarship.
So in what ways do Jonathan Beakey's conclusions challenge some of the ideas that circulate about the historical development of two kingdoms theology?
I think also in his own doctoral work, and Jonathan can speak for himself, but I think he shows a great deal of nuance, and that the current discussion that is going around, particularly, I would say, in the United States, is sometimes at a distance from the historical sources, such as Maastricht and Turretin and others. So I think what Jonathan really contributes to remind people, there was a very nuanced discussion going on, and even in terminology, let us be very careful in what we say and what we not say.
Now, you mentioned earlier on, Adrian, van Maastricht's interest in philosophy, and a number of chapters in the volume deal with his relationship to Cartesian ideas. Elko van Berg, Goshi Kato, are both interested in this particular issue. So in what kinds of ways did van Maastricht respond to this particular way of thinking about the world?
Yeah, I think Maastricht in that regard has followed Fuchs very much. When Descartes came out with the Discourse of Method in 1637, Fuchs debated it and discussed it very soon afterwards at the Utrecht University. And Fuchs became a very, say, anti-Cartesian, and Maastricht follows Fuchs in that regard very careful. And the work, of course, of Asa Gaudriaan must be mentioned here, groundbreaking work on Fuchs and Maastricht and Driessen as early responders to Cartesianism. And that is one of the aspects that is, I think, overlooked in scholarship, and that is where the section of philosophy by Philip Fisk and Cato and Daniel Ragusa really contributes to show people, say, aha, we speak about nowadays about philosophy and theology. You see in Maastricht, he's almost a very pre-enlightened figure that still keeps philosophy and theology very close, distinct, but close. Show that Maastricht is a very, very important voice in discussing Cartesianism. And in a nutshell, the main concern, and that is what you see in Maastricht's writings against the teaching, the philosophy of René Descartes, is that he became very concerned that the ratio reason became another source equally important, and source of knowledge equally important, like scripture. And that is all his work is focused on, the importance and primary importance of a source of knowledge, and that is scripture, and that is not reason. And with the writings of Descartes that became in debate and dispute, eventually arising in the Enlightenment, that reason was another source of knowledge. Maastricht, following, I think, Fuchs, although with his own accents, maybe Maastricht worked out the vision of Fuchs, was really concerned that the status of scripture was undermined by elevating reason as a source of knowledge.
That's helpful. The book ends with a couple of chapters which look at the reception of van Maastricht's work, a chapter by Brandon Crawford and a chapter by yourself. Interesting that both of these chapters take us into New England, which was, of course, the subject of your earlier work in Before Jonathan Edwards that we talked about in this podcast, I think last year, or maybe it was the year before. Brandon Crawford writes about the way in which van Maastricht's work was contributing to discussions about Sandemanianism in New England, and you're interested in discussions of his work or translations of his work into Dutch. In what ways do later 17th, 18th century readers respond to van Maastricht, and what kind of legacy can we see him having in these chapters on his reception?
Yeah. I think these are just two chapters that aim to highlight the importance of reception research, whereby in this case of Brandon Crawford's contribution highlights that Maastricht was a widely respected theologian in his time by multiple parties, and can assist to mediate conflicts. What we see with the Dutch translation, eventually, we see a very similar pattern, even up to the early 20th century. For example, when the Protestant Reformed Church in the United States came into being to separate themselves from the Christian Reformed Church in the 1924 Synod, both parties cite Maastricht, and there are more citations of Maastricht than citing Calvin. It's a very interesting aspect. But I can also point to 1953 in the Netherlands. There was a debate in some Reformed churches. Both parties appeal to Maastricht. And that is his very interesting position. When there are those particular theological conflicts, parties go to Maastricht and consult him and cite him in their support then. But he has this interesting role. So on the reception research, I think is a very important aspect for scholarship to be considered. And this is one of the ways people can think about to do that reception research.
That's wonderful. Well, Adrian, we've taken up a lot of your time today, and it's been great to talk about your new book, Petrus van Maastricht, Text, Context, and Interpretation, just published by Van den Hoek and Ruprecht. But before we wind up, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment?
Before I do this, I want to close concerning this book, the importance to give to young scholars a platform for new research. As you have seen the list of contributors, there are very seasoned scholars, but there are also young scholars. And I think in publications like this, if you really want to stay on top of new scholarship and new directions of scholarship, you have to include young scholars. And that is my hope also with this book, that people can see the inclusion of new and promising scholars like Jonathan Beeke, or the one from South Korea, or the one from Japan, or from the Netherlands, or from the United States. These are the new voices, the next generation of scholars that can help us in showing us new directions for scholarship. Now, coming back to your question, I have decided for the time being not to work on Maastricht anymore. I'm doing something on the reception of Edwards in the Netherlands. I'm doing something on Edwards in Africa, the reception, and I'm working on Edwards, the reception in the German-speaking world. So that are three projects. Two will be published next year, and one will be published in 2022. So for the time being, I hope also with this volume that we just discussed, that a new generation of scholars will pick up on Maastricht and do things that are even beyond my own imagination or desire to go, but help us also to develop scholarship from that point of view.
Well, Adrian, those sound like great projects. I think I may have heard a version of your paper on Edwards in Africa at the Yale conference last year. Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, I look forward to seeing that in print. That was a tremendous paper. But thank you for your time today. Thank you for taking the trouble to come onto the show and for talking about your new work. And thanks for your time and take care.
Crawford, thank you very much for having me on the show, and wish you well. Thank you.
And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.